So, my name is Alain Durand. My office address is 801 17th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20006, USA. So that's my address. And the route I took to come here is a direct flight from Washington Dulles to Dublin Airport and then some taxi to the hotel and another taxi to come here. All this as an introduction to say we're going to talk about names, address, and routing. And always people ask me questions about those things. I sense some confusion. What's an address? What's an IP address? What's a name? What's the difference between the two? And that's what we're going to try to clarify today. So next slide, please. Remember maybe painting by numbers, so we're going to do networking by numbers to try to make it easy. This tutorial is aimed at people who are someone new to the field. This is not aimed at experts, so if you already know about everything network-related and TCP, IP and all this, you are wasting your time here. You might as well go and have lunch. So you might remember the seven layer of the OSI model, and I'm going to extend it from 1 to 7, but from 0 to 9. And so layer 0 is really the physical realm, and there are two types of networks that have fundamentally different properties. One is the wired network, used either copper or fiber, and the other one is a wireless type of networks with antennas. So if you lay out copper or fiber, you need to dig trenches or you need to put wires on poles, and this is pretty heavy investment. And you need to get all kinds of legal authorization to do that. Plus side is you get a lot of bandwidth. You can get gigabit, tens of gigabits, hundreds of gigabits of bandwidth through a single fiber. This is essentially point to point. So if I have a fiber from, let's say, here to the hotel, well, it goes from here to the hotel and nowhere else. Wireless is exactly the opposite. Usually the bandwidth are much, much lower. We're talking about megabits, not gigabits. When you have one antenna, there's an area that you can cover. So you can have one antenna in a city, in a small city, or the entire city. So in rural areas, for example, this is much more interesting because the cost of infrastructure is much lower. But in other places, people don't like antennas. In the neighborhood where I live, it's in a suburb, people don't like to see antennas next to their house. It's good. I rather like to have people digging trenches and bringing fiber to houses. So those are different constraints that you have to deal with. Also, antenna, you are essentially using airwaves, so there's a spectrum issue, and spectrum may be regulated or unregulated, depending on the type of networks you are using. If it is regulated, you may have to participate in auction, or you may have to work with the government to get a slice of the spectrum. So it's a very, very different process altogether. So that means that some of the low-layer protocols for wired networks and for wireless networks, and some of the policies that goes around them are very different. So people tell me sometimes, okay, I need a fiber to go from, let's say, my office in Washington to here. Am I going to have to dig a trench all the way from Washington, D.C. through the ocean to here? Well, the answer is obviously no. If I need another fiber from, let's say, New York to here, am I going to have to really get fibers? No. We're going to share fibers. So the first way to share fibers is in a fiber, you can send light with different colors. You can set red light or green light or orange light. Each light color is associated with a wavelength, and you can send different wavelengths and essentially tune your transmitter and your receptor to a particular wavelength, and if they're sufficiently spread apart, you can have multiple of those. So you can share a fiber among persons. But remember, all this is point to point. So back to my example. If I need a fiber from my Washington, D.C. office to here, doubt there is a single fiber that goes from there to here. There might be bits and pieces of fibers, for example, a fiber that goes from my office to kind of a central office in Washington, D.C., maybe some fiber that goes from D.C. to New York. There might be a transatlantic fiber that goes from New York to, let's say, somewhere along the east coast of Ireland, and then some of the fibers, etc. So what we're going to do is to connect those fibers. Those fibers arrive to some switches. And we are going to create a path by connecting those fibers together. And it might be that we start sending light in a specific wavelength, but arriving at other places in the network, we cannot use that wavelength because it's already used by somebody else. That's okay, because it's going to be retransmitted, and it could be retransmitted in a different color. So by creating all those connections, we essentially interconnect multiple layer one network, create a layer two network, which is this fiber path. Another example of a layer two network is when you have a wireless hotspot in a room, like an 802.11 hotspot. Essentially what it does, it virtual wireless links between the laptop and the hotspot, and each of your laptop is actually connected to the hotspot. There's a mesh network that is concentrated. It's actually not a mesh. It's a hub-and-spoke network concentrated to the hotspot. And from the hotspot on, can go somewhere else. Point is, when you're on this network, or when you're on the fiber path, all the nodes on that network can talk directly to all the other nodes. So if you send just a communication to one from one node to the next, that's fine. But if you start to send, discovery packets that are typically broadcast or multi, meaning I'm going to send a packet to every node on the network. Well, if I have 20 nodes in the network, I'm going to essentially replicate the packet 20 times. Or if there's an access point, I'm going to send the packet to the access point, and then the access point is going to replicate it 19 times. 19 is not too bad a number. Think about if we had 10 billion computers and we need to replicate 10 billion packets. That will be completely ridiculous. So those type of networks don't really scale very much. We need to aggregate them in small pockets and then reconnect those pockets together, but make sure that when there are those broadcasts or when I'm trying to discover things around me, that they don't propagate too far. Next slide. So that's really what IP is all about. Saying that the world is not just one local world. The world is about interconnecting networks. And Paul was talking about the ITF and how the ITF is creating the internet, which is a network of network. That's really what this is about. There's a network for the room here. There might be another network for the other room downstairs. There may be different networks, and we are going to interconnect them. That may be interconnected to the rest of the internet. At the edges of those domains, there will be devices that we call router, or router, depending on how you speak English or American. That will forward the relevant packet from one network to the other. But if it is something like a broadcast packet discovery, that will constrain into the local network where it started. So when we talk about IP, IP stands for Internet Protocol, that's where this is. We are going to give devices an address that will enable them to cross the different networks, go from one computer to the final destination. Next. I forgot to mention that at the beginning of my presentation. I would like to make this interactive, like, so if you have any questions, please feel free to jump in at any time. Layer 4 is about not simply being able to send packets, but about sending data. So a packet is a small chunk of data. It's called sometimes a datagram. Typically, it's about 1,500 bytes maximum. 1,500 bytes is enough to say, hello, my name is, about it. If you want to send a big file, that's not enough. You'll have to send multiple of them. Now, when you send those things, they may get lost, especially if you go through some of the low-C networks and some wireless networks that have some interferences, or if there's some congestion in the network, some packet may be lost. So you need to have a protocol that will make sure that if there are things that are lost, they will be retransmitted. And make sure that you're really talking to the person on the other side and that person is listening to you and hearing you. An example here. I'm going to send a big packet and a big file to Steve. And first thing I'm going to do is to say hello. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Alan.
Nice to meet you.
You too.
So what just happened in this exchange here? I send an initial packet. CP language, we call that a SYN packet for synchronization, saying, hello, my name is. Back to me and said, hi, Alan. By saying that, I know that he has heard me. Because if he had not heard me, he will not say hello back to me. Okay? But at this point of the exchange, if we only do that, Steve doesn't know that I've heard him. He had heard me. He has sent something back to me. But he doesn't know maybe what he said back to me was lost. Well, I have to get a third message saying, it was nice to meet you. Now he knows. Can he hear me? I know, but I can hear him. So it's called a three-way handshake in TCP. And make sure that the two parties in the communication can talk to each other. So now I'm going to send a bunch of data. And I'm going to number them. So there will be first chunk, second chunk, third chunk. Steve, here's the first chunk.
I acknowledge I received the packets of the data.
What just happened here is that he told me that he has received my packet. We call this an ACK in TCP language. Steve, here's the second chunk.
I received that data as well. ACK.
Steve, here's the third chunk. Nothing. I'm going to wait a little bit more. Nothing. That means that probably does not receive my packet. Steve, here's the third chunk again.
ACK, I received that data.
Good. Now he has it. I can keep going on. And because he has not received the previous one, I might think maybe something happened. Maybe there was a wireless network and some kind of plane went to the antenna or next to the antenna and make some interferences, or it went to a router with a lot of people connected to it and there was some congestion, like a big intersection in a busy street. Maybe I cannot send my packet so quickly. So what I'm going to do, instead of saying packet 1, 2, ACK, I'm going to say packet 4,
ACK.
Wait. 5.
ACK.
Now it seems that the communication is working fine. I have slowed down. Maybe I can increase a little bit my speed. Packet 6.
ACK.
Packet 7. Now I need to back off again. That was too fast. So this algorithm is what is going to be the... just a second. It's going to be the TCP exchange to find the proper size of the windows and to find the proper speed at which we question.
Hey, comment, Jason Hines. His acts are not specific. He's just acting and he's not IDing the packet.
You're correct. This is tutorial 101. This is not 301 or 401. Trying to make things simple here. You're absolutely correct. There's another protocol that's called UDP where you can send packet directly and you don't know if they acknowledge or not, don't know if they are received or not. It's used mostly in applications like telephony when you really care more about sending the traffic as fast as you can rather than making sure it has arrived. Higher level, there are some other protocols for real stream, and we were talking about telephony. And in some cases, it makes more sense to drop some packets, not retransmit them. Because if I'm saying something and he didn't hear some of the sentence, or it's a movie that is going through, we don't want to have movie rewinding and then playing a little bit and then rewinding and playing a little bit. Sometimes it's just better to degrade the quality flow going. From human perception, it is a better objective. So those protocols do exactly that. So until now, what we have done is send bulk data, and there's no semantic that was associated to the data that I have sent. So that's fine when you are transferring a file, but if you want to transfer more organized information, for example, you want to go configure a router. Don't want to send a config file and that on the other side they will have to figure out what to do with it. You may want to send something that is already structured. So there are a number of ways to do that, and that's what you do at the presentation layer. And at first, we started by having like some fixed width character strings, and it has evolved. Things like XML have been used for a while. And now the latest thing is called JSON, J-S-O-N. Well, what you see is essentially a dictionary of different values and different IDs and values associated with them. So this is the description of a menu. It's a pop menu. You look at things like OpenStack and a bunch of new tools that have been proposed. This is one of the languages that used pervasively today. Slide. And on top of that, of course, we have application. Because if there's no application, you know, nobody's really interested into this low-level content and data. So application on the internet is really about the web. That's the most dominant application. And HTTP is the protocol to carry the web, Hypertext Transfer Protocol. There's a variation of it, it's called HTTPS, which is a secure version of it. Basically, you use cryptography and encrypt your data back and forth over the communication channel. The beauty of this is that, from a user perspective, you don't have to worry about anything, to the point where kids usually are much better at using those applications than us adults. And it's an incredible proof of success of the entire technology. Sometimes I've scratched my head and I think, like, I'm a dinosaur. I have no idea how to use those new apps my kids do. But none of this makes sense if the community is supposed to serve is not a board. And sometimes it's about a financial issue. You need to make sure that when you deploy something, a new application, a new infrastructure, a new network, that you have some return on investment. Because if you deploy this and nobody's using it, then bank is going to shut you down very quickly. So those considerations are quite important. Sometimes it's not just about financial, it's also about making sure that you have some users that are interested by what you're doing. There's always this catchphrase that there's an app for that, but not every single app is successful. Some are successful because they actually respond to a need. Some are not because nobody cares. Next slide. And all of this, of course, need to be coordinated with a bunch of organizations, so there's a political layer onto that on how things are organized. Political, I mean, how people come to consensus on decisions that need to be made. So there are a bunch of organizations, and previous presentation was talking about the IETF and a bunch of other organizations, so this is essentially a galaxy of those different things. So here we are. This is ICANN right now, where we are now. But there are other things that exist in the world. So this is a quick walkthrough from layer 0 to layer 9 about all those different technologies. So slide, please. Now, let's talk a little bit about, you know, the meat of this presentation, which is about real story started with me having a tooth pain when I was traveling. And it was really, really bothering me, and I really needed to go see a dentist. So next slide. Steve, my tooth is really bothering me. I know that you have been there a little bit longer than I have, and maybe you know a dentist. Can you give me the name of your dentist?
Well, I would suggest Dr. Guinness, but because you're in such pain, I would. Dr. Jameson might be a little bit more appropriate for you.
Thank you. So, what is a name? Well, if you look at the dictionary, the name is a word or a set of words by which a person, an animal, or place is known, addressed, or referred to. Like, my name is Parson, etc. So if I know the name, I know who you are. I know Steve's name. I know who he is. Now, I know his dentist name, not this Mr. Guinness thing, Mr. Jameson. It's a much stronger guy, apparently. And I know who he is. Still doesn't help my tooth pain. So I need to dig a little further. Keep going. So I know his name. So we can talk about Dr. Jameson. I can talk to Steve about Dr. Jameson. Because I have a two usage of a name. I can talk to Steve about Dr. Jameson. A name in itself is useless. It's only interesting when I use it either to start a conversation or to talk about somebody else as a referral. So let's use this doctor. Maybe I really need to go see him because now he's getting bad. Names have scopes. How many Dr. Jamesons are there here in Dublin? In my family, I'm the only one who has the name Alan. So yeah, we'll be at a family reunion and then we say, where is Alan? Well, you know, it's me. No doubt. But when I was in school, grade school, Alan was a very popular French name for kids my age. So usually we had like 3 or 4 Alan in a typical classroom. So when the teacher said, Alain, go to the blackboard, please, 3 or 4 of us were just looking at each other and says, which one? And the teacher asked, oh, okay, Alain Durand, please, blackboard. So if you qualify a name, you can resolve those ambiguities when you have multiple people having the same name. Right? Still, Mr. Jameson is interesting. I have full name. Actually, what is his first name? Jim? Like know. Jim Bean?
Yes.
So Jim Bean Jameson? Okay. I need to find out where he lives. Because if you go in the street and ask a cab driver, take me to Dr. Jameson, most likely he won't know where to go. Yeah, well, me. So what do I do? Well, you can take phone book and go and look for Mr. Jameson at the letter J, or go to dentist and look at there. You can ask somebody, where is Steve? Where does Mr. Jameson live?
I think he's at 125 Root Canal Drive.
Thank you. So I can ask somebody else to tell me where it is. And I have now the information I can use to tell the cab driver. This process is called name resolution. So when we talk about DNS, we talk about name resolution. It's to map out from the name to something that I can execute at a lower level, which is an IP address in DNS names, or in that case, a real street address. Next slide, please. So a parenthesis here about different topics that have come up in the recent years about names, and especially DNS names. First one was internationalization. So initially, names were written with character only, and uppercase, no lowercase. That's fine in America. It's not as fine in France when we have those weird characters, E with an accent or C with a cedula. And in China and Japan, that's absolutely not fine because they don't have even those characters to begin with. So all those efforts were quite important and are still going on. DNS authentication. The address of Dr. Jibison again?
125 Root Canal Road.
I know that's the real address. How do I know that he is not sending me into wild goose chase? Well, there are two issues. The first one will be, am I really sure that I'm talking to Steve? And the second one is, I have actually the correct knowledge of where the address is. Maybe this Dr. Jimison has moved in the last 6 months, and Steve doesn't know about it. So DNSSEC is trying to address essentially the first part of the problem, making sure that this is transferred securely, and there is a key associated with it, and that key has been signed by the person who owns the data, in that case by Dr. So I know that, yeah, this information is going to be correct. Third aspect that has been discussed in the recent years is the expansion of the root zone. So in the beginning of the internet, there are a number of countries called TLDs, .uk, .fr, .jp, .ie, and the global names were .com, .gov, .org, .net, and a couple others. In recent years, you have seen many other TLDs being created, and you have a full list downstairs and a bunch of people who are deploying this market now. So those are really the three more recent issues that have changed this technology that was created long, long, long time ago. Now let's go to this address, like 125 Root Canal Road. An address, going back to the dictionary, is a particular of a place where someone lives or an organization is situated. So essentially, if I know your address, I know where you are. So sometimes I had borrowed money from some friend and they said, we know where you are. Okay? Meaning that don't pay the money back, meaning they know how to find you. That's what an address is. Next. So a little detour. So as I mentioned, I live in Washington, D.C. So this is one of the most famous buildings in Washington, D.C., just next to, around the corner from my office, actually. And the address is 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20500-0003 USA, complete address. First thing that you can notice is there's a hierarchy here. You have to read it from the right-hand side all the way to the left. So the hierarchy is USA. This is not in Ireland. That's not in the USA. This is DC. Well, DC is not exactly a state, but well, that will work. This is in Washington, so that's a city. NW is northwest, means that's in the northwest quadrant, because some streets are on different parts of the city. That's on Pennsylvania Avenue and on the number 1600. So there's this very nice hierarchy. Not all addresses have the same hierarchy. For example, in the US, there's a toll-free phone number system, 1-800. So they say dial 1-800 and go buy something. You have no idea where the end of the call is. Sometimes it's not even in the US. It could be rerouted somewhere in India, in Ireland, in China, anywhere. Also, cell phone numbers. I have no idea where a cell phone is. Example, in our origin country, in France, all cell phone numbers start with 06. I have no idea that person is in Paris, in Nice, in Monaco, in Lyon. No idea. There's no hierarchy whatsoever. IP addresses. There is nothing in an IP address that tells you where this IP address is. You can look at an address like, for example, 128.30.8.1. Nothing there that tells me if it is in US, in France, in Ireland, in China. Nothing. Now, what has been done is that people have collected statistics about addresses and have built some database that says, oh, this particular address is geolocated in this particular country, in this particular street address. Some people have built those. It's an afterthought. It's not part of the address structure. Same way as names, addresses have scopes. So if you live in D.C. and you ask for the address of this little white mansion, people will tell you it's 1600 on Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest. They will stop where it ends. They don't have to tell you it's in Washington. They know that. They don't have to tell you this is in the USA. They know that. But they have to tell you that it's on Pennsylvania Avenue, and they have to specify that it is Northwest, because there's also a Pennsylvania Avenue North, Southeast or Southwest. So there's a logical point where you have enough information given your local scope to figure out where it is. Another example, if I ask anybody here where is Paris, they will say it's in France. People our flights. Where I live in D.C., there is, in Virginia, a small village called Paris. There might be like 50 houses in there. In the mountainside, I'd like to go there sometimes on a motorcycle, just on a nice ride on the countryside. So when I tell my friends, oh, I'm going to Paris, and I'll be back in an hour, well, you know, that's what I mean. I'm going to this local Paris, not to the other Paris. So there'll be some confusions with addresses. And we have to make sure that you qualify them with the right scope. So we are mentioning with names that names can be handled, and we can use them either directly or as a reference. Same thing, I can put the name, I can put an address on a postcard and send the postcard right there, or I can ask my friends, if, again, the same question, what is the address of Dr. Jameson?
125 Root Canal Road.
Thank you. A reference that he is giving me that I can use. The notion of talking to somebody or talking about somebody, using things directly or as a reference, is always constant in this internet architecture. Next slide. Now that I have this address and I can put an address, for example, I want to send a postcard to the White House, address I gave you, but that doesn't guarantee the postcard will make it. What guarantees that the postcard will make it is essentially a system that has been put in place that's going to take this postcard and move it from places to places, maybe on a plane or on a boat, on a ship, or on a car, on a truck, so that it arrives. This system is, postcards is a post office. They will find a route, send the my parcel, in that case my postcard, to the right. So we rely on those system, underlying system, to actually move things around to the correct address. So on the internet, what type of addresses do exist? Well, we have two protocols on the internet that have been defined. There are three of them. The first one was NCP, but it's long, long time forgotten. The current one is IP version 4. It was defined in 1981 and is still used now. An IP address is described using 32 bits. So you have 2 to the power of 32 possibilities. That's about 4.9 billion. There are a number of addresses that are reserved for some special purposes. I talked about multicast earlier, for example. So in practice, there are only 3.2 billion addresses that are usable. IPv6 has been designed in the early 90s because we realized that 3 billion addresses will never be enough. There are more people on Earth than that. So we need something larger. IPv6 has 128 bits, 2 to the power of 128. So it's not just 4 times bigger than 3 billion. If somebody knows how to pronounce that name, please let me know because it's a huge number. Essentially, that's if you want to put an IP address on every grain of sand on the planet, we'll still have a lot more. There's no worries about running out of IPv6 address, at least in the next few years. Question? Why did they name it 6? Very good question. So I'm going to repeat it. Why is it IPv6 and not IPv5? Why do we skip over 5? So Paul told you about the registries that IANA maintained for the IETF. And that's a perfect example of that. There is a registry for IP version numbers. So it's a 16-bit, it's a 4-bit field, so you can have 16 values from 0 to 50. When IP, the next generation, was defined, somebody went to that registry and says, what is the next value that is available? Turned out that somebody had already reserved a 5. And it was for a protocol called ST1 and ST2, which was for a streaming experimental protocol, but they had already reserved a value. Okay? So we don't want to duplicate value in those registries. So we went and took the next value that was available. That was 6. When IP next generation was defined, there were actually 3 candidates. There was one called that SIP, one was TUBA, and the other one was PIP. And some of them merged. Some of the other were documented for historical purposes. So what they did is they went and allocated version 7, version 8, and version 9, I think, in the registry. So if you go in that registry, you will see those things. It's not that they are going to be used. We want to be able to refer to them in the future. That's why those values have been reserved. So if there's a new version of IP defined by the ITF in the future, it will not be IPv7. It actually probably be IPv10 or V11. Type is? So I was mentioning those 0.2 billion addresses. And I'm sure you have heard about IPv4 exhaustion. So it's not an IP address get tired by walking too long or being too long on the plane. What is happening is that all of them have been allocated, a few of them. But the internet is growing. So what do we do? First answer that most people have is, okay, use IPv6. You know, it has been standardized 20 years ago. Just go ahead and use it. Problem is that they are not compatible. It's another type of VHS versus Betamax type of thing. For those who are old enough to remember our days. They are simply not the same protocol. They are not compatible on the wire. Like, this is an American plug. That's an Australian plug. Doesn't fit. Sorry. Limitation. There's nothing to do with policy or anything. It's not compatible. So, there are equipment on the internet, like modern computers, like my laptop. I'm sure your laptop too. That support both port 4 and V6. But there are devices that don't. Very often the home router, home gateway does not support V6. Or bought a TV set not that long ago. It's supposed to be a smart TV. I can stream things like Netflix, Hulu, and a couple others. TV has a firmware that supports only IPv4. Tried to replace that firmware once and almost bricked my TV. I had to be on the phone for 2 days with a customer service from the TV vendor, and it helped me to solve that situation. Honestly, I think I know what I'm doing, and I failed miserably. So I don't expect, for example, my parents to be able to change this low-level software on their TV, which means that all those devices, consumer devices, and it's very important now when we're talking about Internet of Things, all those devices that are shipped will never, ever be reprogrammed. Software, the low-level software we call the firmware, on those devices, once left the factory, can touch it. Cases where it can, but it's very, very rare. So if those devices are shipped today with something that supports only IPv4, for the lifetime of this device, it's going to only support IPv4 and no IPv6. So if you start to see a lot of gizmos, electronic gizmos today for Internet of Things, that IPv4, I will never do IPv6, end of story. Which means that from a service provider perspective, you cannot simply say, I'm going to offer you IPv6 and forget about IPv4. We need to provide both as a service. Now, it doesn't mean that every single device has to be configured with both, but it means that as a service to your customers, you need to offer both. So it's going to be like that for a very, very long time, because we still see new gizmos, new electronic devices popping up at Fry's Electronic in the US, Best Buy, or whatever the local is in different countries, that are IPv4 only. And the reason why they're IPv4 only is simply because the people who design them says, I want to roll them in people's home today. Around the world, most places have only IPv4, not IPv6. Very few have IPv6, so why should I bother? This is one of those cases of late mover advantage, not first mover advantage. That's why it takes so long for this technology. Next, so back to IPv4. All the efforts that we will do to IPv6 will really, really help. But as I mentioned, we still need to carry on IPv4. Now all the addresses have been allocated. What do you do? Well, there are two things that can be done. The first thing is, most of the IRs now, and Lightning, I think, is the last one who is working on it, have what's called a transfer policy. But enable people who have network numbers that they don't use, transfer them to people who don't have those network numbers but would like to have them to use it. Optimism for selling IP addresses. And this market has started. We're going to talk about that a little bit. Terms and conditions vary. Different regions have different policies on how you can transfer or not. But this is when you left the station now, and there's a fairly healthy market around that. The second technology that is going to help here is network address translation. This is something that everybody has been using in the home. This little home gateway that connects the home to the internet actually creates a local space inside of the home, and only one global IPv4 address on the outside. So it's going to translate the address on the inside, that address in the outside. Now, service providers are using exactly the same technology in the core of their network and share addresses among different subscribers. So in my previous job, I worked for one of the equipment vendors that built some of those stuff, and we very easily put 100 customers behind one IP address. So we can multiply the space by 100. In some cases, we have seen some extreme ratio of up to 5,000. So if we simply stay with a very, very conservative number. Let's say that somebody gets a block on the transfer market of, let's say, slash 16 in IPv4 world, which means actually 65,000 addresses to a power of 16. Say 65,000. I don't have enough to really make a business plan to serve customers, 1,000 users. That's nothing. But if I multiply this 65,000 by 100, now I'm talking about 6.5 million. 6.5 million is enough for a decent-sized service provider in the country. So multiplying the space by 100 is a big deal. Statistic about this market. This is the number of transfer per month. It's a bit of an eyesore. You can get the slide somewhere. What we see a couple hundred transfers being made every month, but not all transfers are the same size. So next slide. So if I transfer and look at what size this transfer is and I addition all of that, what does is essentially we have been transferring about 25,000 slash 24s. Those are the old classes, networks that can have 255 addresses. If you multiply that by the number of addresses in each of those networks, essentially this shows that we are transferring about 5 to 6 million addresses a month. You multiply that by the average price of an IP address on those market, dollar, it's a very, very large market. It's a very large
market. Have remote participants too. Thank you.
Now, I just noticed a huge peak February 2015, especially in Aaron. What happened there that all at once out?
There was a very large transfer that was made.
Okay.
Oh, at least, let me reward this. There was a very large transfer that was awarded in Aaron. Very different from being made. Now, okay, and we talk about addresses and things. Remember, this whole story began because I have a toothache. I really need to go on a taxi to see Mr. Jameson. So I need a route to go to Mr. Jameson. So maybe the taxi driver doesn't really know how to get there, and he's going to drive, and he's going to look at signs on the road, and that will take him to the next city where the Dr. Jameson is. Those signs on the road, they don't show up spontaneously when the taxi driver gets on the road. They have been put in place there by somebody long ago. But it means that if you rely on a system to essentially take you somewhere, that system has to be built, and those routes have to be computed way before you start sending traffic. So that's essentially the same thing that we are going to see here. So a route, or route, depending again on your pronunciation, is a way or course taken in getting from point A to point B. So if I have a route, I know where to go. Remember, if I have a name, I know who you are. I have an address, I know where you are. I have a route, I know where to go. Next. If you only remember one thing from my tutorial this morning, you have a name, you know who you are. You have an address, you know where the route, you know how to go there. So, we are talking about building this infrastructure and those direction signs on the intersections. We do the same with internet. So, this is usually built the reverse way. So, the destination is going to say, I'm here. If you want to reach me, send me packets. The router, just before, is going to receive that announcement and says, okay, I know that to get there, I need to send the traffic to this link. Fine. Now, this router is going to advertise for all these other links to all his neighbors. I know how to go to Dr. Jameson. I know how to go to that destination. Now, both adjacent routers knows this. If I want to go to Dr. Jameson, I need to talk to this guy. This is, oh, I know a guy who knows how to go to Dr. Jameson. Same thing, we will propagate. And this one we say, I know a guy who knows a guy who knows how to go to Dr. Jameson. And that's really what the internet is about, is I know a guy who knows how to get there. And remember, I have your address. So at some point, we are going to build all those routes. Next slide. So now that those routes have been built, I can send traffic. So this route building happened in the background, and it's being refreshed every 30 seconds, every minute or so, but it has been built long ago. So whenever somebody wants to send traffic, those routes have already been calculated. This is not something that's going to be made just before the transmission start. It's something that's happening in the background all the time. So when I'm going to send traffic, I'm going to read those signs. Like I go to an intersection and it says, Dr. Jamieson, take the left. Dr. Jamieson, take the right. That's all it is. So I'm going to look in a table and says, I want to talk to Dr. Jamieson. I need to send the packet to that guy because he told me that he knew a guy, we knew how to get there. And this one is going to do the right thing, which means sending the packet to the next hop. So you see here, there is a collaboration process. It is really at the core of the management and the functioning of the internet. There's a collaboration process when we build those routes, when I hear announcements from one side of a network, and I'm going to propagate them to all my neighbors. And there's also a collaboration process, which is the reverse, exact reverse of hype. When I'm sending traffic now, so remember, first one was operational, building the routes. Now this is sending traffic. I'm going to forward the traffic to somebody else. And this is a collaboration that is at the core of the internet. Why, for example, exchange points are being built, where you simply try to transfer the packets to the nearest possible place. So there used to be examples where in a country, two universities could not exchange traffic directly. They had to send traffic offshore, overseas, maybe to New York, and there was an exchange point in New York, and it was going over the ocean again. Country. This was totally inefficient. It was done for a number of complex financial reasons and politics. At some point, they decided that makes no sense. And what they did is they put a node very close to both universities, so when they had traffic that was going between the university, it will not have fiber. So they found a better route. They decided to collaborate to make the situation better. And really, that collaboration is at the essence of the internet. Next slide. Now, what happens if there's a bad guy that abuses this collaboration? What happens if there's a bad guy that inserts himself in the system and says, I know how to go to Dr. Jamieson. Come here. And I'm going to speak louder than the real guy that knows how to go to Dr. Jamieson. Maybe that's a plot from Dr. Guinness, because all his customers have been sent to Dr. Jamieson and he doesn't like it. He wants to get the customers back. So don't pay attention. Traffic might get there because somebody is subverting the system. So the same way as DNSSEC, it was there to help us to guarantee that the name could actually translate to the real IP address, or IPsec. That means when we have an IP-level communication, we can have cryptography and make sure we are sending, we know that the right endpoint on the other side. There's a technology here that's called RPKI, for Resource Public Key Infrastructure. It's going to be used by the networks, not by the endpoints, but by the networks. When they hear an announcement or somebody saying, I know how to go to Dr. Jamieson, that's going to be cryptographically signed. There's a public key infrastructure, and we can check this announcement to see if the signatures verify. If it does, great. If it doesn't, then we drop the announcement. So that will prevent route hijacking, for example, or route insertion. There's still a lot of debate around this technology. It's not widely deployed yet. Main topics of discussions are, you have a public key infrastructure, great. Is there one route to that key infrastructure, or are there multiple routes? Is it one per region, for example, one per IR, one for Europe, one for America, one for Asia Pacific, one for Africa, one for Latin America and Caribbean, or is there one route, a single route that is an IANA route? Or is it country-based, or is it region-based, or is it the multiple discussion on that? The second theme of discussion is we can verify the origination of a route, but can we also verify the path and make sure that it doesn't go through unauthorized third party? Because somebody could be simply inserting himself into the route and eavesdropping on the traffic, and we may or may not want that. So still work that is ongoing around that. Right? So after all of this, I ask my friend Steve, who's your dentist?
Dr. Jamieson.
Oh, interesting. Where does Mr. Jamieson live?
He's at 125 Root Canal Road.
And which way do I need to go to Jamieson?
Well, I know that way.
There you go. That's what the basic technology of the internet are about. You can go to this dentist, next slide, please, and then he will help me with my toothache. The end of my presentation. Any further questions? I will be happy to answer them now. Question in the back.
Sorry, it's not just a question, but any chance to get that slide, copy of that slide?
We're working, this is actually a very thick deck with pictures, so we're working on getting this slide deck onto the agenda. If you drill into, through the agenda this session, it should be up by probably the end of today, early tomorrow.
Have a question?
Hang on 1 second.
Thank you, Nigel Casimir, Caribbean Telecoms Union. The RPKI thing, is it still in development, or to what extent is it deployed in service right now? And what do you see as the prospects for its ultimate full adoption?
There's software that has been developed. It has been running for a while now. You can get some of the keys, signatures, certificate from the different IR. So if you want to go to ARIN or RIPE or AFRINIC or LACNIC or IPNIC, you can get one of those ROA, as they call it. Is it widely deployed? Not. And that's essentially because there's still a lot of discussion about this AI infrastructure. Is it going to be rooted in a single place, or is it going to be in multiple places? And to answer the last part of your question, what I think the prospect of it is, until this discussion is really settled, it's difficult to think that there will be massive deployment. That's really hindering the process here. The question is, are we at risk of hijacks? And I'm going to give you a yes-no answer. Yes and no answer, to be more specific. Yes, we are at risk of hijack. And hijacks have happened in the past. We remember there was some incident in Pakistan, for example, that had been well-published. But now service providers have learned. And because of this collaboration among service providers, incidents like that are fixed very quickly. So are we at theoretical risk of hijack? Yes. Are we at practical risk of hijack? I would say not as much. And if you look in the headlines in the last couple of years, we have heard about a lot of breaches in credit card centers, in Sony movie pictures, and all of that. We have not heard a lot about root hijacking. So because of this strong cooperation between service provider and lower, it has been mitigated. And in the back?
I have one very practical question, if I may. You think about the Internet of Things, where everything is going to be hooked onto the Internet, not only the computer, but the washing machine, the dryer, the fridge, the TV, and so on and so on. This could mean something like 20 to 50 devices in the home. How will this work? Does the home have to be rewired, or will this go wirelessly to a hub or something like that? Could you explain a little bit more on this practical question?
Yes. In my house, I think I have something like 10, 15 devices already. And I seriously think that in the next year or two, I may have 50 devices or more. Do I have to change anything in my infrastructure in the house? No. Because all those devices are essentially wireless, 802.11 something. I may have to change my home gateway. Because some of home gateways have some limitation on the number of devices. And this is, again, in their NAT table. They have some older algorithm on how to do that. But that's essentially the only thing that needs to be changed from an infrastructure perspective.
Jason Hines, back to the topic of the route hijacking. When you said there was collaboration between the service providers, I was wondering if you can tell a bit more how that collaboration works. Does it depend on them coming to meetings and being aware of best current practice or best documents, or just out there in their world commercially, they're operating, they automatically adopt whatever they need to.
So it's a good question. So what is really the cooperation mechanism that exists? So first you have all the NOG meeting, like NANOG in North America. NOG means Network Operating Group. LACNOG in Latin Caribbean, AFRNOG, and you have in Asia Pacific, it's called there's a RIPE community also. So you have all those meetings where service provider go. Yeah, Carib NOG, and I think there's a main NOG for Middle Eastern NOG, and all those things for large or small regions. Fabulous opportunities for service provider to exchange information about what are the current threats, what are the state-of-the-art ways to deal with those threats, and how do we rationally defend against that. Also, there are some informal communications that are happening. We all know each phone number and the Jabber ID, and there's all kinds of communication happening directly from the network operating center ISP. So if something shows up, something happened, they will know very, very, very quickly. When the very first incident on the internet happened, it was back in 1989, you may remember the Maurice Worm days, for everybody in the community, in the service provider, to react to this. Now it will probably take less hours. In the back? Follow-up and then a question in the back.
Thanks. So my concern is if there's any risk, if you're not participating in the NOGs, like the RIRs or something where you have to get the address, are they pushing out information to on the
yes.
best practice?
Yes, and very often the IR meetings are held jointly. They're held jointly with a NOG meeting. For example, last week, 2 weeks ago, in Montreal, the first part of the meeting was NANOG from Monday to Wednesday, and Aaron was from Thursday to Friday. And many people just attended both meetings. When you're traveling, 3 days or 5 days doesn't make that much of a difference.
Outside of going to the meetings, though, I'm from the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. I see low Caribbean participate a lot of these meetings. So I'm wondering, are my service providers more at risk because I don't see them as frequent or in large numbers at these meetings?
There are a lot of things that is happening in the Caribbean region. I know that Aaron is having some on-the-road workshops over there. NANOG has the same thing. LACNIC is also very active. There are many, many opportunities. There are mailing lists also for people who don't travel. There are a lot of resources that are available on the web. On if you go to the NANOG or LACNIC website, you will find a lot of resources there.
Also a lot of cross-pollination within the mailing list, too. So even if you might be in the Caribbean region, your IS might be joining AFNOG or APRICOT because collection of expertise around the world. So they might have more than one avenue. And so, Alon, you're saying that networking isn't just digital, though, in order to make this happen. You've got to have a human element, too, to it.
Yes, absolutely. This is about the human element.
Alon, using your metaphor of name, number, and route, where do DNSSEC and DANE map into that?
So DNSSEC is really about making sure that when I ask Steve, what is the address of dentist, Dr. Jameson?
125 Root Canal Road.
This is all about knowing that this information is correct. It might be that somebody is in between the two of us and is hijacking the communication and sending bad. Or it might be that somebody has corrupted is local information, and on good faith, Steve is telling me some bad data. That's what DNSSEC is all about. Now, DANE is more work in progress. I don't know, Steve, can you talk more about this?
Actually, I don't. I haven't been following it in a while, so I don't want to give wrong information because of...
So, this is work in progress in ITF. My understanding of it is to make sure when you ask a question, that the question cannot be intercepted by somebody else. There's privacy in that question, because I may want to go somewhere and I don't want anybody to know that I'm going there. So I don't want anybody who will be listening to the network to know that I am trying to go Dr. Jameson. Because if I know that I'm trying to go Dr. Jameson, meaning that I have a toothache, meaning that I'm not exactly receptive to what is happening here, and can use this opportunity to maybe pass some policies under the nose that I will not normally pay attention to. Well, I will normally pay more attention to. I can create more interesting examples about that, but that's really what it is to protect your privacy when you're asking those questions.
And DNSSEC can be sometimes misleading because even though it sounds like DNS security, it's not actually data. It's more like DNS auth, authenticating the data. DANE and some of the deprive stuff that's happening in the ITF is more about protecting the content of the data, that it's only the host or the. Any other questions?
Any questions on the remote participants?
Let me check our remote participants. We do not have any questions from the remote participants. So, Alon, I'd like to thank you for joining us today. And am I back on? Okay, giving us an overview on internet networking. We are on a little bit longer break. We ended up early. We'll be back at 2 o'clock with registry protocols. And again, selfless plug, please take a second, go to this website, give us some feedback. We got a great turnout today, but we don't want to ever run into the diminishing returns aspect. And so having new ideas, what we could talk about that's relevant to you and relevant to the ICANN community is super important. So please take, it's 10 questions if that, take a second and give some feedback. So Alon, thank you.
Thank you very much for your attention today.
All right, we're going to go ahead and get started again. Last time I walked behind the TV and it clicked out, so now I want us to walk in front of the TV. We have Ed Lewis here. I won't even begin to list the plan and the things he's seen. So Dr. Seuss here will give us a hand. He's worked at registries. He's been a professor or still is a professor.